This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents The Congruent Wizard, Book 2 of The Congruent Mage, written by Dave Schrader, performed by Peter Kenny. Chapter 1. The Battle of the Quarry. More than a dozen flying discs bearing green-cloaked wizards poured over the 100-foot rim of the quarry. Most of the attacking wizards had one or two soldiers armed with swords and crossbows crowded around them on their yard-wide discs. Some soldiers carried buckets and shovels. The sun would be up soon, but for now, the only illumination came from a glowing sphere of light cast by Dothan. Furcha shouted, "Vero!" and launched herself at the tall, dark-haired wizard leading the attack. He was standing alone on his disc and seemed to be directing the other green wizards. Buckets and shovels, thought Einan. Of course, he realized, to collect green mage stones. Merry, Elderman and Dothan angled their flying discs to engage the rest of the attacking wizards directly. But Einan remembered the strategy the Griffin had used on the old ball wizard and sent his flying disc above all the other combatants so he could evaluate the scene and attack from an unexpected direction. Below, he saw Furcha and a wizard in green robes, who must be Vero, exchanging lightning bolts that crackled, boomed, and echoed off the quarry's walls. Rocky, the black wyvern, who had somehow adopted him, was darting in and out of clusters of Tamlock wizards, using his body to disrupt their flight. Einan's staff was still tucked into the scarf tied on the big beast's back. Rocky flicked his tail right and left, knocking four attackers off their flying discs when they were close to the ground. Einan saw them fall 10 or 12 feet to the hard floor of the quarry. Only two of them got up. Chi wasn't fond of the conflict, and retreated from Einan's shoulder to hide inside his jacket, making nervous chi-chi-chi-chi sounds while the battle raged below. Merry and Dothan were following five Tamlock wizards as they dove to the quarry's floor, dropped off their soldiers, and swooped back up to a higher vantage point. The older wizard sent a congruency ahead of two of the five and used it to release torrents of water onto the retreating Tamlock wizard's spherical shields. With a gesture, he sent a gust of chilled air at the water that was so cold, the liquid froze around the shields, blinding the wizards and weighing them down. The pair of attackers descended rapidly and broke their ice shells when they made hard landings. Einan was impressed by Merry's skill using thin beams of tight light. He hadn't learned that sort of magic, though Daemon had used it against him. Apparently, the beams could carry force, not just light and heat. Merry used dozens of beams the width of her little finger to set the other three Tamlock wizards' spherical shields spinning, making the wizards who'd constructed them twist in dizzying circles. Far below, Nud was firing his crossbow. At first, he'd been aiming at wizards on flying discs, but now there were enough soldiers on the ground that he'd shifted his focus to them. Unfortunately, some of the soldiers were shooting back, so Nud had retreated to crouch behind a quarryman's wagon 10 yards behind his previous position. Drawing on the expertise of his borrowed blue mage stone and his red mage stone's power, Einan created a curved translucent red wall of solidified sound between the wagon and the Tamlock crossbowman. Nud immediately shifted from direct shots to arcing fire, sending his bolts over the wall and down into clumps of soldiers. The blue mage stone somehow maintained his construct without continued attention from Einan. He turned to look for Daemon, expecting to find the old wizard using spectacular magic to stop more than half the attackers at once. Instead, he saw Daron's master mage casting a massive construct of solidified sound in the shape of a giant dome above the quarry, keeping out a third of the attacking wizards, including Vero, and preventing the ones below from escaping into the clouds. Speaking of clouds, Einan caught a glimpse of something purple inside a low cloud that was almost a fog bank. He didn't have time to investigate it, because the wizards above Daemon's shield had seen him and were headed in his direction, ready to blast him with their own selected forms of wizardry. Einan deployed a defensive sphere of solidified sand around him, leaving a small hole in the back of the sphere to work offensive magic. He created a lens to accumulate magical energy, like the one he'd used against Daemon during his testing yesterday, and prepared to take whatever the green-garbed wizards decided to throw at him. He pretended to cower in fear of his attackers. It wasn't hard to do, but he hoped they'd be the ones truly worried in a few seconds. While his opponents were positioning themselves for attacks from all directions, Einan was subtly moving small bubbles of transparent, solidified sound under the edges of the flying discs controlled by the 6 green-clad wizards arrayed around him. His hands were balled into tight fists, keeping the bubbles tiny. Then he flung his hands open in a fast, fluid motion, and all the bubbles rapidly expanded to 10 times their original size, catching the green wizards by surprise and tipping their flying discs almost to vertical. 2 managed to hang on, but the other 4 fell like rocks toward the quarry floor. They didn't fall far, however. Damon's shield was in the way. The attackers from Tamlok hit Damon's construct and slowly slid along it, pulled down the shield's slope by their own weight. Einan watched them try to slow their descent with their boots and palms pressing against the curved surface. The 2 remaining attackers were trying to tilt their flying discs back to horizontal by shifting their weight, so he set them rotating with nudges from their enlarged bubbles. That should slow them down, thought Einan. He glanced below to check on Nud. The big man was out of his own quarrels and was scavenging bolts the Tamlok soldiers had shot at him before Einan put up his protective shield. Einan saw Nud shoot 1 more missile from his crossbow, then start waving his arms and shouting. He was too far away to hear what Nud was saying, but Einan realized the soldiers with picks and shovels had filled most of their buckets with green stones. Green mage stones, Einan assumed, dug up from just beneath the quarry's floor. One of the wizards guarding the soldiers holding shovels and buckets launched a fireball over her head. It exploded below Damon's hemispherical shield in a shower of glowing green sparks. Einan watched Vero push Furcher away from him with a large expanding bubble of solidified sound. The tall green wizard dove toward the protective dome Damon had created. A tight cone of verdant energy shot from the mage stone on Vero's cuff and punctured Damon's sphere like so much soap film. Vero sped toward the floor of the quarry, like a hook-beaked Aloysius swooping down on a squirrel. The few remaining green-garbed wizards in the air followed close behind him. Soldiers in green, carrying weapons and full buckets, joined the wizards on the ground and somehow found room on their flying discs. Stunned wizards and injured soldiers were placed on fallen flying discs, slaved to the wizards who were still capable of flight. Before any of the Daron wizards could react, Vero created a large circular black gate a foot above the ground. The Tamlok wizards and soldiers shot through it as fast as a herd of sprinting pronghorns. Vero was the last to leave. The gate closed with an audible snap behind him. Below, and to Einan's right, Furcher shouted Vero's name in frustration. Then she added a series of words Einan hadn't heard since one of his uncles had smashed his thumb with a hammer while trying to mount a wagon wheel back on its axle. Einan smiled and filed the words away for future reference. 30 feet down to his left, Damon was creating a small circular black gate of his own. He dropped through it like a rabbit down its hole. To Einan's surprise, Merry followed Damon across the congruency's interface before it closed with its own snap. Furcher paused her string of frustrated invectives. She had glimpsed the same hint of purple in a cloud above that Einan had seen earlier. She leaned forward on her flying disc and sped up toward the suspicious cloud, with Dothan a few heartbeats behind her. Einan watched a wizard in a strange purple robe emerge from the cloud and cast a 3rd congruent gateway. Her dark hair was piled on her head in elaborate braids, and her purple mage stone pulsed in the center of a rectangular gold plate hanging around her neck. The purple wizard took 1 last look at the scene below, and unhurriedly directed her flying disc through the gate. Furcher and Dothan followed her at high speed. Then that gate snapped closed. Nud was shouting now, probably in frustration. He and Einan were the only remaining defenders, but all the attackers and observers had left. Before Einan could descend to reach Nud, a small bubble of solidified sound under the leading edge of Einan's flying disc inflated, flipping it from horizontal to vertical. Einan was able to grab both of the flying disc's foot straps as he slid down and found himself hanging below his disc, which had turned completely over. He lost 25 yards of altitude and found his feet kicking below him like a flying frog churning butter. Einan felt like he might lose his grip and fall 20 feet onto hard stone if he didn't regain control of his flying disc quickly. Chi picked that moment to crawl out of Einan's jacket and sit on his head. The raconette's tail tickled the back of Einan's neck and made it more difficult for him to concentrate on keeping his grip on his flying disc.
"Stop fooling around and get down here," shouted Nud from below. "We've got work to do."
Chapter 2 Nud and Einan. Einan managed to regain control of his flying disc and didn't bother to right it. He descended at an angle to land in front of Nud, taking a few short steps to cancel his forward momentum. Rocky was already on the ground nearby, resting from his exertions. Chi jumped off Einan's head and scampered around on the ground, picking up fragments of green rocks.
"Sorry," said Einan. "I didn't expect one of the green wizards to use my own trick against me, especially with a time delay trigger."
"It pays to figure out how to defend against your own tactics," said Nud, "because I guarantee they will be used against you."
"That's good advice," said Einan. He lowered his flying disc and put it down, then double-checked to make sure everything in his pack was still secure, before strapping his flying disc on top of it. Nud nodded.
"What next?" asked Einan.
"Help me recover Quarrels," said the taller man. "I wish Damon, Dothan, and my mother had stopped a plan instead of popping out through random gates without thinking. Was the young redhead your girlfriend?"
Einan wasn't expecting Nud's question. He flushed and replied in a rush without thinking.
"Uh-huh," he said. "Her name is Mary. She's from Avelgoth, and she's incredibly smart and well-read and wonderful. She taught me my first spells. We were travelling downriver to Typhoid together."
Nud nodded again, then smiled at Einan's enthusiasm.
"My quarrels have blue and white fletching," said the big man. "Pick up any of those you find, and any of the Tamlock quarrels that are close to the same length. Once that's done, we can plan."
"Right," said Einan.
He started to search for Nud's quarrels near where the Tamlock soldiers had been digging. "Found one," he said after a few seconds. Chi put down the green stones, joined Einan, and helped recover more quarrels.
"There should be at least a dozen," said Nud. "I had 18, minus the 5 or 6 that hit their targets."
Einan continued to look. He could feel the magical energy of more green mage stones emanating from the holes around him.
"Where did everyone go?" asked Einan, as he kept searching.
"I'm not sure," answered Nud. "But if I had to guess, I'd say that Damon and your girlfriend are in Ryas, and Dothan and my mother are somewhere in Ochiden's province, Nova Eberacum, maybe."
Einan tried to ignore Nud's teasing about Merry.
"Why would Damon and Merry take a gate to the capital of Tamlock?" he asked.
Then he answered his own question with another question.
"To see what that green wizard, Vero, was up to?"
"That's my bet," said Nud. "Damon has friends. Spies, really, in Ryas. He probably wants to check with them in person."
"Why do you think Furcher and Dothan are in the Eagle People territory?"
"The purple robes are a giveaway," said Nud. "The Eagle People are the only ones to wear that shade."
"Her mage stone was purple too."
"That's the colour Roma wizards prefer," said Nud. "Though they sometimes use black ones."
"Made from obsidian," said Einan.
Nud's eyes widened when he looked at Einan. It seemed like he was surprised at himself for being surprised Einan knew the word.
"What's Roma?" asked Einan.
"That's what the Eagle People call themselves."
"Thanks."
Einan had pretty much figured that out from context, but he appreciated the confirmation. There wasn't much he could do to help Merry or Damon or Dothan or Furcher, for that matter. He tried not to worry, and hoped Merry and Damon would get along well, though he had his doubts about Merry putting up with Damon's teaching methods. He kept picking up quarrels, and mused that it was far better than picking quarrels, like he did with his little sister. Braith was probably up now, feeding the chickens. She wasn't far away, and neither were his parents.
"Would you like to stop at my place for breakfast while we plan?" asked Einan. "My family lives nearby, and my parents are great cooks."
"Breakfast sounds great, and I'd love to meet your sister," said Nud. "She has long braided red hair and freckles, right?"
Now it was Einan's turn to smile. Nerd had been isolated 2,000 miles away to the west in Melin Carrig, the site of Master Mage Elderman's castle, and a major school for Daron's wizards for many years. He hadn't had much of a chance to meet young women close to his own age. Braith would certainly appreciate Nud's attention, even if she was too young for courting. Red hair in braids, freckles, a lovely singing voice, and can shoot a plum off a post at 100 yards with a longbow. Mind your manners around her. She's only 14.
"You will find me the epitome of decorum," said Nud. "But forgive me if I admire her."
"There's a lot to admire," said Einan. When he thought about it, Einan realized he wasn't just saying that because she was his sister. Braith was growing up, and would soon be on her wander year. He hoped she didn't settle too far away from Haywall. Then he realized he was likely to end up far from his home village, in a wizard's tower somewhere, maybe one he shared with Merry, if they both survived the upcoming conflict with Tamloch. He couldn't see any king, let alone one as mercurial as young King Dario, tolerate an invasion and theft of mage stones by a foreign power, which would likely escalate and accelerate the next war.
"Here's the last Tamloch quarrel," said Nud,
tugging a green and yellow fletched bolt from the wooden side of the quarryman's wagon. "And here's the 12th one with blue and white fletching," said Einan, stooping to pick it up.
"That should be all of them. Is it time to leave for breakfast?"
"If Rocky is awake," said Einan. The black wyvern opened one eye, then the other, and yawned, showing impressive dentition. Einan was glad Rocky liked him. The great beast flexed its wings and allowed Nerd and Einan to board. She held onto a pair of protrusions further up the wyvern's neck, where he had a good view. After a glance to confirm everyone was secure, Rocky launched himself into the air, and Einan directed him southeast toward Haywall. "I've got to land away from the milking barn," thought Einan. "Half the cows would go dry if they saw a wyvern." It seemed like less than a minute for Rocky to fly the 2.5 leagues from the quarry to Haywall. Einan used a ball of tasty, magic-infused solidified sand to guide the wyvern down to a stone square just east of his home. Rocky landed to one side of the village well in the center of the square. Several cottages, including Einan's, screened Rocky from the milking barn. Most people in Haywall were still in the barn or making breakfast, but Braith was near the middle of the square chasing a chicken who seemed determined to drown itself in the well instead of peck at grain. She jumped back on Einan's shoulder. When Nud and Einan stepped down from Rocky's back, Braith was there to meet them, holding the confused chicken upside down by its feet.
"What are you doing back?" she said, smiling at Einan. "Wonder years are supposed to be a year and a day, not a week and a day. And who's your friend?"
"I'm Nud,"
said the big man, trying to stand tall.
"Not you," said Braith. "The wyvern."
Her eyes were dancing, and Nud gave Braith a slight bow to acknowledge her teasing.
"That's Rocky,"
said Einan, sweeping his arm to indicate the wyvern.
"Who's your other friend?"
Nud puffed his chest out, waiting to be introduced.
"This is Chi,"
said Einan. The little raconette puffed his chest out, imitating Nud. Then Chi bowed and shifted to Braith's shoulder from Einan's. The little beast reached down and shook Braith's hand, then offered her a damp, dried cherry.
"I wouldn't eat that," said Einan. "It's probably been in his cheek pouch."
Braith rubbed Chi under his chin, and the raconette's body seemed to vibrate in happiness. Einan finally took pity on Nud and introduced him.
"This is my new friend, Nud. Pleased to meet you. I'm Braith."
She gave Nud a slight bow of her own. "And this," she indicated the chicken,
"is dinner."
"Or maybe breakfast," said Einan.
"Do you think we could talk Mother and Father into making us some? If it will give them a chance to hear what you've been doing since you left home, I think you can count on it," said Braith. "Though it might be wiser if Rocky went hunting for deer on top of one of the mountains first. People might talk."
Einan laughed. He was sure other village dwellers had spotted the big wyvern, and tongues would be telling the tale for several decades to come.
"Would you like a nice white-tailed deer for breakfast, Rocky?"
he asked. The wyvern's head bobbed up and down. Einan still wasn't sure how much the beast understood, but there seemed to be some sort of bond between wizard and familiar. He sent the sphere of solidified sound, arcing up towards the mountains to the east, and Rocky rose to follow it. Einan hoped he would find a wild deer, not some farmer's prize ewe to dine on. Braith motioned to Nerd.
Our house is this way.
Nerd and Einan followed his sister and the chicken, the younger man grinning at the older. Braith turned and took in her brother's red magestone in its intricate gold setting.
You have been busy, haven't you?
Chapter 3 Damon and Merry. Merry bumped into someone. Elderman, she assumed. And they bounced off something. Probably a wall. It was hard to tell because she couldn't see. It was as black as Queen Cashel's cats, wherever they were. From the echoes of her footsteps, she could tell the ceiling was low. She smelled cider and beer.
Where are...
she began to ask. A hand covered her mouth, and Merry could feel warm breath near her ear.
Quiet, girl, whispered a voice she thought was Elderman's. Wait until I see if it's safe to speak.
Merry nodded, and the hand moved away from her mouth. She felt Elderman shift around her, then heard the distinctive creak of old wooden stairs behind her. A crack of light appeared, and Merry turned around. The old wizard had lifted a trapdoor at the top of the stairs and was peering out into whatever space was above them. As her eyes adjusted to the low light, Merry could see huge tons of cider, wine and beer along one wall of a low-ceilinged cellar. They were nearly as tall as she was. She spotted a loading ramp at the far end of the space where the huge casks could be brought into the cellar, and a square platform with ropes and pulleys around it that could serve to raise a ton to the next level. Taffin's Inn had a similar cellar in Tyford. Merry increased the glow of her new magestone and used its light to read what was burned into the ends of the casks. Samad's Ale, read one that smelled like beer. Five Lakes Grape's Blood was the label on a large tun of wine. She ran her finger around the tap. It was a sweet and fruity red. Merry remembered the Five Lakes region was in western Tamloch, at least according to her father's maps. The lakes, which looked like five fingers on a hand, were in territory that had frequently passed from Tamloch to Darren and back again. She thought they were under Tamloch's control at present. She nearly stumbled over a smaller barrel stored horizontally, on a short, X-shaped frame that kept it off the ground. It looked familiar. Merry leaned in to read the logo etched in its lid, then pulled back in a hurry. Applegarth Select, read the inscription.
How did Applegarth cider end up in a cellar next to Five Lakes Grape's Blood Wine? Merry wondered.
She didn't have long to think on the question. Elderman was coming back down the stairs.
There's no one upstairs in the pantry, said the old wizard. It's safe to leave. Follow me.
They ascended the stairs together, and both pushed the trapdoor up. Merry held it in place for Elderman to exit. Then he returned the favour and gently lowered the door back into place. The room above was wide and deep. The mechanism for raising tons of beer and wine was in the back, and a strong iron-banded oak door was at the opposite end.
"You're Elderman?" asked Merry.
"Call me Damon," said the grey-haired wizard. "Elderman makes me feel old."
"But you are old," said Merry.
"Not you too," said Damon. "It was bad enough to hear that from Einan."
Merry smiled.
"Sorry, Damon."
"Whatever made you decide to follow me to Ryas?" asked Damon. "I'd planned to make this a solo reconnaissance."
"It seemed like the right thing to do. I'm Merry, by the way."
"Humph," said Damon. "I'm seldom of that disposition. Not for 2 decades, anyway."
"What happened in those ancient times to change your outlook?" asked Merry.
She waggled her eyebrows, and one corner of Damon's mouth turned up for an eye blink.
"That's too long a tale for present circumstances, lass," he said. "For now, I need to see if the kitchen and common room with the blue whale are occupied."
"On the other side of that door?"
asked Merry, indicating the stout oak portal.
"Let me."
She went through the words and gestures needed to invoke the listening spell and put her ear to the door.
"There are 2 people in the kitchen, one large and one small, from their voices and breathing," she whispered. "The common room sounds empty. I can't even hear spoons scraping bowls."
Merry stood up and crossed to move next to Damon. Why are we in Ryas, by the way? Are we chasing Vero?
I'm trying to find out what he's up to first, said Damon. Vero plays a long game, but so do I. Once we know, then we can act.
That makes sense, said Merry.
Her tone was uncertain, however, as if she wasn't sure anything Damon had said truly made sense.
What's the Blue Whale?
An inn and tavern near the Royal Palace, Damon replied. It's a great place to hear gossip.
Hmm, said Merry,
remembering the bench on the Street of the Jewelers in Tyford, where she liked to read and listen. Damon moved to open the door. Merry grabbed his elbow.
Stop, she said. I told you, there were two people in the kitchen.
The older wizard pushed her gently aside and pulled the heavy oak door open on silent, well-oiled hinges.
Don't worry. They're friends, of a sort.
Of a sort? Came a deep voice from the kitchen. And you're a wizard of a sort, old man.
The door opened all the way, and Merry saw a short man with a fringe of foxtail-coloured hair, wearing a stained linen shirt, green breeches, and a green apron. His midsection resembled the sort of cider barrels that would last a farm family for a year. Next to him, in a similar outfit, but wearing a long green skirt instead of breeches, was a tiny woman, whose waist was smaller than one of the short man's upper arms.
Don't tease him, Tippo, said the woman. He'll turn you into a toad. Never, dear Tannis, said Damon. I'd have to change him into the namesake of your inn, to use up all of him in the transformation.
I'd be more of a dolphin than a whale if you tried, said Tippo. Good to see you, you old scoundrel.
He shook Damon's hand, then gave him a crushing hug. Tannis stood on her tiptoes and kissed Damon's cheek when Tibbo had finished.
"Who's the young lady?"
asked Tannis, finally noticing Merry.
"Don't tell me you have another grandchild," boomed Tibbo.
"To the best of my knowledge, I'm no relation," said Merry, stepping forward.
"You're still welcome at the Blue Whale, lass," said Tannis. "Would you like some breakfast?"
"That would be lovely. I'm Merry, from Applegarth."
"Are you now?"
said Tannis, with a soft lilt that made it seem like a question.
"Breakfast sounds like a fine idea," said Damon.
"I'm sure you're ready for some good home cooking with the way Damon feeds his apprentices," said Tannis, looking Merry up and down.
"I'm not one of—" began Merry.
"You can see she's perfectly healthy, not wasting away from lack of nourishment," Damon interjected. "You know I love your cooking, dear lady, but I'm in a bit of a rush and need information while we eat." "I'll bar the front door and set four places at table," said Tibbo.
As he moved out of the kitchen and into the common room, Merry could see the big man was light on his feet. She spotted a heavy cudgel leaning against the back of the bar on the other side of the pass-through from the kitchen, and expected Tibbo was quite effective at quelling any sort of disturbance inside the inn. He effortlessly placed the thick length of wood by the front door in a pair of iron brackets, ensuring no one would enter from that direction with anything short of a battering ram.
"How do fried duck eggs, sausage and fresh manchet bread sound to you, dear?"
Tannis asked Merry.
"Wonderful," Merry responded.
"It might be worth lifting a knife and fork for," said Damon. "Feed him gruel and bacon drippings," said Tibbo from the common room. "I'll eat his eggs."
"You'd eat an old shoe if someone put gravy on it," Damon responded.
"But with Tannis as my wife, I don't have to," said Tibbo. "She's the best cook in Tamloch, nay, in all of Orluin."
"There's a young man I know I'd put up against her for that honour," said Damon.
Merry put her hand on the old man's shoulder. He turned to her and she smiled. He was talking about her Einan, she was sure.
"What can I do to help?" asked Merry.
"You can slice the bread," said Tannis. "It's in a box behind the dough trough."
Merry spotted a long, narrow and deep carved piece of wood, the size and shape of a child's toboggan, leaning against a kitchen counter a few yards down. Her mother had one just like it for kneading the big batches of bread dough a household went through every week. This one had not worked along its outside edges. Merry was glad her mother's wasn't ornamented. The tiny crevices inside the intertwining designs would be a wolf and a bear to keep clean. She pumped water in the sink across from the hearth and washed her hands, Then she found the bread box, opened it, and took out a round loaf near the front.
"This one?"
she asked, holding the bread up for inspection.
"That's it," said Tanis.
She'd already put a huge soapstone griddle on the coals, which Damon helped along with a touch of fire magic. A string of a dozen sausages hung from a wrought iron hook near the griddle, and the tiny woman was cracking eggs into a glazed green bowl.
"Use the knife on the left side of the block to slice it."
Mary found the knife and a cutting board and proceeded to methodically cut the round loaf into neat, even slices. The munchit bread was white, made from fine, double-sieved flour instead of whole wheat flour with husks included. Her mother only made munchit bread on special occasions. She cleaned off the knife and returned it to its place in a block, then carried the cutting board and sliced bread to Tanis. The tiny woman was pouring eggs on the griddle next to the sizzling sausages.
"Put that bread here beside me," said Tanis,
patting a four-legged wooden footstool to her left. Mary did as she was instructed.
"Now, be a dear and grate me some cheese," said Tanis,
pointing at a white block on a plate resting on the edge of the hearth. Mary removed her dagger from her belt and sliced thin slivers from the block of cheese until she'd collected a sizable stack.
"Will this do?"
she asked.
"It's perfect," said Tanis. "Add the cheese to the eggs, please."
With the back of her dagger, Mary pushed the cheese onto the cooking eggs. Tanis was scrambling them about with a flat metal turner in one hand and turning sausages with a long two-tined fork in the other. When all the cheese was distributed, Mary put the plate with the remaining cheese back on the hearth. She noticed the left half of the broad soapstone griddle was empty.
"Should I put the bread on to toast?" asked Mary.
"Ask Damon how he wants his," Tanis replied. "I like toast, but my Thibaut doesn't. He says it makes bread taste like burnt beer."
"That doesn't make any sense," said Mary.
"Neither does Thibaut half the time," said Tanis. "He finds it helpful to be underestimated."
Mary got up and walked across the kitchen to lean over the pass-through to the common room.
"Do you want your bread toasted, old man?"
she asked with a smile in her voice.
"Yes, infant," Damon replied, "if you can manage not to burn it."
"I'll try my inexperienced best," said Mary,
resolving not to tease Damon quite so much. She returned to kneel next to Tanis.
"Toast for three," she said.
"That means toast half the loaf," said Tanis. "Thibaut will eat the other half."
"Guard your plate or I'll eat your bread too, toasted or not," said Thibaut.
Mary could hear the smile on his face, even though he was out of sight.
"Come out and help carry the food to the table," Tanis commanded.
Thibaut joined his wife by the fire, took a pair of thick wool mittens off the wall, and picked up the entire soapstone griddle before carrying it to one of the long trestle tables in the common room. Damon and Thibaut had set places with trenchers and salt for eating, plus pewter goblets filled with strong ale for drinking. The soapstone griddle was placed in the centre of the table and where everyone could help themselves. Mary carried the untoasted manchet bread slices to the table, and Tanis followed with a crock of butter marked with a four-leafed clover on top. That made Mary think about the crock of Flying Frog Farms butter she'd shared with Einan. She felt her cheeks get red at the memory of that and what had happened after, and hoped the others would attribute her flushed face to her work at the hearth. Once they were all seated, Tanis passed around the turner and sausage fork. When it was Mary's turn, she took a generous portion of eggs, two sausages and two slices of toast. When she spread butter on the manchet bread, its white surface turned gold. Damon lifted his glass, and so did Tanis and Thibaut. Mary lifted hers a second later.
"To the blue," said the old wizard.
"To the blue,"
echoed Tanis and Thibaut, with Mary joining in a beat late with,
"The blue."
Did they mean the inn? The blue whale? Then she understood. The blue was the kingdom of Darren. She should have realized it. She was in the midst of spies.
"Well,"
said Damon, clearing his throat after swallowing a bite of sausage.
"You probably want to know what Vero is up to," said Thibaut.
"Of course I do," said Damon.
"I'm not the one you need to talk to then," Thibaut continued. "Sal's your man. He's been working in Vero's tower for a fortnight, pouring drinks and cleaning goblets."
"Fine," said Damon. "How soon can I talk to him?"
An odd pattern of raps sounded on the front door. One rap, another, then two close together, then three, then five. Mary recognized the sequence. She hadn't heard it since she was a child. But it couldn't be.
"Sal has a good head on his shoulders, but he can be quite melodramatic with his secret knocks," said Tanis.
She laughed like a small bird chirping. Thibaut got up to unbar the door, and Mary followed. The short, barrel-chested innkeeper removed the length of wood, and a tall, well-proportioned young man with curly red hair, a pointed beard, and a bright smile on his face stepped inside. His jaw dropped when he saw Mary. Her eyes were wide. After a long second, she spoke.
"Solda? I thought you were dead."
Chapter 4. Furcher and Dothan. The sun was farther up in the sky when Furcher and Dothan emerged from the gate. Ahead of them, the purple-robed wizard was hovering above a cluster of other wizards on flying discs, moving in strange patterns and smacking balls of solidified sound with an odd assortment of magical constructs. There seemed to be four levels of play, if what they were doing was indeed a game, and Dothan became so entranced with the player's motions that he stopped following the purple-robed wizard. Furcher had to circle back to get his attention and redirect his focus back on their quarry. Dothan's distraction didn't matter, as it turned out, because the purple-robed wizard moved her flying disc to join them.
"Welcome to Nova Eberacum," said the wizard in purple robes.
Small wisps of dark hair escaping her beaded braids danced around her face in the wind. The purple mage stone on the gold plate resting on her neck glowed with a steady light.
"You're Dothan," she said. "We've got quite a lot of information about you."
She smiled at Dothan. He didn't notice.
"And you must be Furcher. Perhaps you'll be able to fill in the blanks on our records of your career during your visit with us, Domina."
Furcher spoke in her usual blunt manner, while Dothan had difficulty shifting his attention away from the wizards below.
"Why were you spying on Darren?"
The Roma wizard laughed. The ease of her voice, as she did, made it clear she laughed often.
"A rhetorical question, I'm sure," said the wizard in purple. "Everyone spies on everyone else these days, and always has. If it's any consolation, I wasn't spying on you. I was spying on Vero."
Now Furcher laughed.
"That's much more understandable," she said. "Trouble buzzes around Vero like flies on carrion."
"From that reaction, perhaps my records about your relationship with Prince Vero are incomplete," said the purple-robed wizard.
"He's not a prince," said Furcher quickly. "He gave that up when he chose to learn wizardry. And your records are woefully out of date regarding my feelings about that son of a..."
"What are the rules?" interjected Dothan, joining the conversation at last. Furcher stared at Dothan like he'd grown a second head.
What was it about serving as the leading mate of Darren that turned every man filling the role into a complete idiot, she considered.
"For that matter," said Furcher, "since you seem to know so much about us, who are you?"
The wizard in purple robes first answered Furcher, then Dothan.
"My apologies. My name is Letitia. I'm the spymaster for the governor of Okiden's province."
Letitia moved closer to Dothan and spoke louder to be sure she got his attention.
"The game is qua qua quator quadratum, and the rules are quite complex." "Ah, so you're Letitia. Your fame precedes you," said Furcher.
"It's called Foursquare."
"Correct," said Letitia. "And sometimes the duck game, because qua qua easily becomes quack quack."
"That's the duck game?" asked Dothan. "I've heard about it, but never seen it played. It's supposed to be how the wizards of the Eagle people practice for war."
"Also correct," said Letitia. "There are four rising square levels, black, green, blue, and gold, for earth, crops, sky, and sun, with a congruency in the center of each. Teams of wizards push balls of solidified sound through lower congruencies, and they come out through one a level higher. The team that pushes the most balls through the most congruencies, when all 16 balls have been played, is the winner."
"But what about..." began Dothan.
"Please," said Letitia. "Come to the governor's palace with me to break your fast, and I will have one of the master qua-qua strategists of the province instruct you in the nuances of the game.
Dothan nodded at Letitia and returned to following the motions of the players below.
"I take it this is more a command than an invitation," said Fircher. "One thing our records did say about you is that you were wise, at least in some matters," said Letitia.
Fircher smiled, letting Letitia's implied criticism roll off her like water off the back of a goose.
"And if we attempt to get out, there are more than 30 well-trained wizards just below us, counting players, officials, and spectators," Letitia replied. "I wouldn't advise it."
Fircher tugged hard on the sleeve of Dothan's robe, tilting his flying disc and getting his attention.
"It's time to go," she said. "We're having breakfast at the palace. You can learn more about Quaqua there."
"Very well," said Dothan reluctantly.
"This way," said Letitia,
indicating the stone citadel and city built at the tip of the island below, near where the Abernoth River emptied into the sea.
"Do you think you'd be able to arrange a meeting with the provincial governor?"
asked Fircher, thinking of opportunities to enlist the help of the wizards and legions of the Eagle People in the upcoming war with Tamlok.
"I'm certain we can," said Letitia.
"How can you be so sure?" asked Fircher.
"He trusts my judgment explicitly," said Letitia. "And he's my husband."
"I never knew I liked pickled lark's tongues," said Dothan. "It's the honey, almond milk, and saffron reduction that makes the dish," said the governor,
Quintilius Marius Africanus, a very tall, well-muscled man, with tightly curled greying black hair, who looked like he was carved from a block of obsidian. The provincial governor had a ready smile and a strong voice. He had insisted Fircher and Dothan must call him Quinn, and they obliged. Quinn and Letitia had been plying them with wine and delicacies, seated at padded wooden chairs around a mosaic-inlaid table rather than reclining on couches. Fircher was happy to be sitting up. She'd always thought it was uncomfortable to eat lying on her side. She drank sparingly and kicked Dothan's shins under the table when the governor's servants had filled his goblet a third time. The fundamental rule of diplomacy and espionage was to say little and listen more. Dothan was saying a lot, but Fircher was thankful it was only about Quaqua. For her part, she thought the complex game might have a lot to do with why the Roma wizards were more effective in combat than those from Daron and Tamlok. The two kingdoms' crown wizards were masters of palace intrigue, not battle strategy, and the soldiers who led their armies played drinking games, not Shamat. Fircher had seen a Shamat board and carved onyx pieces in a library they'd passed on the way to the dining chamber. She'd need to keep her wits about her.
"So, the young king wants to make a name for himself and create his own legacy," said Quinn,
as he spooned fish sauce on Dothan's salmon fillet with dill and white wine.
"I did the same when I was young. Did I tell you about taking Timbuktu for the emperor?"
Letitia whispered to Fircher,
"He tries to work that into every conversation with someone new."
Fircher smiled and nodded, sure that both she and Dothan were being squeezed for information by a pair of masters.
"Is that what earned you a governorship?" asked Dothan,
who seemed to have shaken off his fascination with Quaqua for the moment.
"Indeed it did," said Quinn. "You should have been in Roma to see my triumph."
"He says that to everyone new, too," whispered Letitia. "Is that why Quintilius was sent 2,500 miles away to be a governor?" asked Fircher softly. "Crossing the ocean is a bit more of a logistical challenge than crossing the Rubicon," replied Letitia. "Why were Veru's soldiers digging rocks from a quarry in Daron?"
Fircher smiled, but only to herself. Build intimacy, then pump for information. That was what Vero had done to seduce her so many years ago. He'd even married her before she'd slept with him. She smiled to herself again, thinking of Vero pumping away, then trying to worm secrets of Daran's conclave of wizards out of her during pillow talk.
"I don't know," said Fircher. "Perhaps they needed greenstones for a mosaic floor in her new palace." "Perhaps," said Letitia.
"Do you think Dario will send his troops up the Brenhaven or the Moraven?" asked Quinn,
trying a similar tactic on Dothan.
"Who can tell?" said Dothan. "He's a fool and follows only his own counsel."
An unpredictable enemy can be a challenging one, said Quinn.
For his own people as well as his opponents, Dothan replied.
All four of them laughed. Letitia made a subtle gesture with one hand, and the servants withdrew from the room.
Enough fencing, she said. It's fortunate that two senior members of the Darren Conclave, including their acting Master Mage, followed me through my gate to Nova Eboracum. I had to keep it open long enough for the two of you to enter, after all.
They all laughed again, Fircher and Dothan nervously.
What was Letitia up to? Fircher wondered.
The spymaster continued.
We know that you know Tamlock's source of mage stones in the Green Mountains is mined out. Without new mage stones, they wouldn't be able to train new wizards, giving Daron a long-term advantage. We don't know how many usable green mage stones they were able to gather from the quarry in the west of Daron. Certainly fewer than they would have if you and your fellow wizards hadn't been present.
Fircher and Dothan had the presence of mind to nod sagely, as if Letitia was only telling them things they already knew.
It is in the best interests of Occident's province and the Emperor to have Daron and Tamlock evenly matched and at each other's throats, instead of one decisively defeating the other, added Quintilius Martius in his deep, powerful voice.
Therefore, said Letitia,
the wizards and legions of Occident's province are prepared to assist Daron in the coming conflict, Quinn continued.
With a proper enticement, added Letitia.
Enticement, said Fircher. Bribe, you mean?
Why do you think Daron needs your help, not Tamlock? Asked Dothan.
Letitia raised an eyebrow and lowered her chin the length of an apple seed.
Quinn answered Dothan.
Because, as you say, your king is a fool.
Dothan shrugged, accepting the characterization of his monarch.
And because King Tuathel of Tamlock is a wily old wolf, smart enough to get others to fight his battles for him, Quinn added.
Dothan and Fircher both nodded, keeping their faces like stone to avoid revealing anything that might damage Daron. The four of them sat like statues for a few moments, before Fircher gave in first. She turned up her palms on either side of her plate of sweet Liebum cakes.
What do you mean? She asked.
Tuathal has paid the dragonship raiders of Bifurland to attack Brendinas in force, Letitia replied.
They should be there in days.
Oh, said Dothan.
What sort of enticement did you have in mind? Asked Fircher.
Letitia leaned forward to share her proposal. Chapter 5 Nud and Einan. Einan's family fell in love with Chi. The Raconette charmed Einan's mother by helping her set the table, and assisted Einan's father with cooking by passing him bowls of chopped herbs to add to the eggs he was scrambling in a large frying pan above hot coals. The small beast had set a place at the table for himself, and imitated Einan's every move as he ate what his father had cooked. It had been hard for Einan to keep from laughing when Braith managed to change into her fancy festival day outfit with its black skirt, white blouse, and intricately embroidered red vest in the brief interval between arriving home and sitting down to eat. During their shared meal, Nud and Braith exchanged so many glances Einan lost count. It was entertaining to watch the two compete to see which of them could smile more at the other's stories. After a quick breakfast, Chi stood up on the table and marched along its length, formally shaking hands with Glynis and Dafydd and Braith in turn. He earned a small bag of dried cherries from Einan's mother for his courtesy, before climbing up to his usual perch on Einan's shoulder. All five of the humans, and Chi, left the cottage and stood blinking in the early morning sun. The two young men were ready to leave Haywall Village after only half an hour. Einan hugged his mother and father, while Chi hopped down to chase chickens before returning to his favourite spot. Nud bowed to Braith, and she curtsied in return. It was clear they wanted to hug each other, but they refrained while Einan and his parents were looking on. Einan could see that his parents were having the same problem keeping their laughter inside that he was.
If anything did come of Nud and Braith's interest in each other, thought Einan, that would be fine,
if it happened after Braith started her wander year. He wouldn't mind having the big man as a brother-in-law. By that time, Nerd would be 24, and Einan's sister would be 16, which wasn't an unheard-of age difference among the farm families in the Coombe, especially if a farmer had waited to have his own land before marrying. Still, as far as Einan was concerned, it was a good thing he and Nerd would be flying off soon. Einan's parents had been pleased to meet Nerd and happy to see Einan. They were particularly surprised to see a red mage stone in a gold setting around his neck. It was clear they weren't sure what to make of their son any longer, especially when Braith told them about Einan and Nud arriving on Wyvernback. Nothing remotely like this had happened in the Coombe in living memory. Braith gave Nud a long, dark, wool-hooded cloak to replace his wizened-skin coat, which she stored for safekeeping. The cloak had been a hand-me-down to Einan from an even taller cousin, and not really Braith's to give, but he didn't say anything. At least it fit Nud well. Einan gave Braith his wizened-skin coat to store as well. The weather was warmer here, and heavy coats were no longer needed, even when flying. Just before they left, Braith took a small basket from her mother and presented it to Nud.
"Some food for your trip, kind sir," said his sister.
Einan didn't laugh, but he wanted to. He couldn't remember his sister saying "kind sir" to any man or lad in quite the same way before. His little sister was growing up. Nud gave Braith one last bow and thanked her and her parents for their hospitality. Braith stood on tiptoe and stuck a fresh cutting of holly leaves in Einan's cap, replacing leaves that had lost their colour. He inhaled the scent of the new leaves and kissed the tip of her nose the way he had the first time he'd left home to wander. The sun was an hour above the eastern horizon, and it was time to leave. Nud and Einan climbed on Einan's flying disc and headed toward the eastern mountains, where Einan had sent Rocky to look for deer. When they had flown a few miles from Haywall, they landed on an empty field beside a narrow track. Einan sent a sphere of solidified sound high in the air, then exploded it in a shower of red and blue streamers. From a nearby hill, Rocky trumpeted the news that he'd seen Einan's signal. The wyvern launched his body high in the air and glided down to join them in the field. Einan pretended he didn't see the wall stuck in Rocky's teeth. Einan gave Rocky a large ball of tasty solidified sand magic to lick, while he and Nud climbed on the big beast's back. His staff was still tucked in place, secured by the scarf Nud had given him when he'd set out to find his mage stone, what seemed like ages ago. He sent the ball off to the east, above the same mountains Einan had climbed on the first day of his wander year, just over a week ago.
"Where to?" asked Einan.
"Brendinus, I guess," said Nud. "We have to tell the king and the conclave what happened. Head east, and I'll fine-tune our course as we go."
"Sounds like a plan," said Einan. In the back of his head, he was thinking about the conclave of wizards. They sat together, side by side on Rocky's back for several minutes without speaking, watching the green land flow below them. Nud broke the silence.
"Your parents are nice," he said. "I spent most of my life surrounded by wizards, and nice is not the first word that comes to mind to describe them."
"I'm a wizard, and I'm nice, I think," said Einan.
"Yes, but you're the exception that proves the rule."
"Dothan seemed quite nice. So did your mother, and Merry is very nice."
"I expect you haven't spent enough time in Dothan's company to tell one way or the other. And you're certainly wrong about Furcher. She's many things, but one thing my mother isn't is nice."
"Doesn't she send you cookies and sweets?"
"Yes, on my birthday and festival days. But I know she buys them in Tyford."
"Oh," said Einan. He'd never had cookies baked at a bakery, just his own or ones from friends or relatives. He wondered if they tasted different somehow.
"There's Applegarth," said Einan,
pointing down to his left. "It's just west of the Ruthru. That's the river heading north."
"I see it," said Nud. "That's where your nice girlfriend is from."
"Uh-huh," said Einan. "Her father is a baron."
"Right,"
said Nud, with a tone that said he had more to say but wasn't saying it.
"What?"
"A farmer's son and a baron's daughter in love. It sounds like one of the old tales that doesn't necessarily end well, that's all."
"Some of the old tales have happy endings," Einan insisted.
"And some don't," said Nud.
I hope your story is one that does.
Thank you.
Your sister is nice, too.
Einan kept his answer short and clipped. Yes, she is.
Don't be that way, said Nud. I'm not going to arrange a rendezvous with her in the hay barn while you're asleep. Not that I could if she didn't want to. It's just that I haven't seen a young woman who couldn't blast me with a fireball or zap me with a lightning bolt since I've become a man. It's a lonely life looking after Damon at Melincarrig.
Why did you stay? Asked Einan.
Damon and my mother insisted it was for my own good, said Nud. They both said I should stay out of Brendinas.
Which is why that's where we're going?
Exactly, said Nud.
Are you sure you're not related to the young king? Asked Einan. You're making as much sense.
I certainly hope not, said Nud.
They flew on in companionable silence. Nud and Einan must have both fallen asleep. It was understandable, since neither had gotten much rest the night before, and the rush of excitement from the battle had worn off hours ago. Rocky continued to head east, following the sphere of solidified sand Einan had set in motion. The young wizard was the first to wake. Einan was initially disoriented, and might have fallen if not for the long knitted scarf that tied him to the wyvern's back. He saw a ribbon of blue water dividing the land beneath him.
Nud, wake up! There's a big river ahead. Is it the Brenavon?
Einan knew Brendinas was on the Brenavon, the Royal River, not far north of where it met the sea. Nud yawned and looked down over the leading edge of Rocky's wing.
I think that's the Moravon. The Great River, said the big man. And that city must be Tyford. I think it would be wise if we stopped there. Damon has a knowledgeable friend who runs an inn in Tyford. It would be a good idea to get his advice before we go to the capital.
Is his name Tafan?
Do you know him? Asked Nud. He's one of the most trusted members of Damon's network of informants.
No, but Merry and I were taking 4 tons of cider down the Ruthro to deliver to him, said Einan. She said he was Applegarth's best customer.
He was quite pleased at the thought of visiting Tyford and its street of booksellers, then remembered they were in a hurry and needed to inform people in the capital about the Tamlock raid on the quarry west of the Coombe. Rocky stayed high, just under the clouds as they approached the city.
There's a big square in the centre of town, said Einan. Should I direct Rocky to land there?
It might be smarter not to land a wyvern inside the city walls, noted Nud. They have archers, and he might not be well received. There's an island in the middle of the river that looks uninhabited. It would be better for Rocky to land there.
Then how will we get from the island to Tafern's Inn? Asked Einan.
Nud smiled.
You are new at being a wizard, aren't you? You still have a flying disc strapped to the back of your pack.
So I do, said Einan. There's a clearing at the north end of the island that should be fine for Rocky.
With plenty of squirrels and a few wild shoats grazing on acorns to provide him with entertainment, added Nud.
And a snack, said Einan.
Minutes later, they were on the ground, and Rocky was sticking his long neck into the trees, helping Chi annoy the squirrels. Nud and Einan were skimming above the river, heading for Tyford. Soon they could see the docks and buildings lining the Moravan's eastern shore.
How will we find Tafern's Inn? Asked Einan.
I don't know, said Nud. We may have to stop someone on the street and ask the way.
Einan recognized a design painted on the end of one pier, jutting out into the river. It was a wide, wavy blue line between 2 red apples.
Wait, said Einan. That's Applegarth's mark. This must be it.
They hovered and inspected the pier. It looked like there was a stone dock farther back underneath it. They went into the shadows and landed on its rough granite surface. Einan tucked his magestone inside his shirt and strapped his flying disc to his pack, hiding its shape with his bedroll. He didn't want to advertise he was a wizard. Broad, iron-banded double doors were at the back of the dock. They led into the lowest floor of a sturdy wooden building. Einan tried to open them, but they were locked.
That makes sense, thought Einan. This must be where Merry would unload the cider for the inn. Tafern's storerooms must be on the other side of those doors. Of course he'd keep them secured.
Nud stepped forward, lifted one of the dark metal rings in the middle of a door, and used it to knock 3 times. The sound echoed underneath the pier, bouncing off wood and stone and water. Nothing happened for a minute. Then a small door above the knocker opened, and an eye looked out.